Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. We're sitting alongside president and founder of the Hoban Law Group, Bob Hoban. Today we are talking about the impact of coronavirus on incarcerated communities, and we are joined by cannabis renaissance man, Steve D'Angelo. Steve, thank you for being here with us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me. Delighted to be here.
And tell us for a second about how life has been affected in the Oakland Hills of California by the pandemic.
Well, the entire Bay Area was one of the first places in the country that was put on what they called a shelter in place here. But we're all basically staying at home, with the exception of essential businesses. And cannabis has been declared an essential business in the state of California. And that applies to our entire supply chain. Perhaps unsurprisingly, you know, given what everybody's going through right now, and it's certainly not the way that we had hoped to boost sales, but Harborside and the entire industry in California is seeing a significant increase in sales now. We had our best day ever last Monday. People need cannabis during this period of time. We're all adapting. I think most dispensaries across the state now are instituting a curbside pickup delivery if they have that capacity. We fortunately just opened our drive-through facility in the Coachella Valley, so that is a safe way for people to obtain cannabis. And I think, like everybody else, we are trying to manage our anxiety, trying to take care of the people we love, trying to understand as best we can what's going on, especially at the federal level.
Well, and Steve, for somebody who's been in this industry and around the cannabis plant for as long as you, how large of a paradigmatic shift is that for cannabis businesses to be deemed essential services?
Well, it's a tremendous shift, and I think that it is a testament to the effort of the work of generations of activists going way, way, way back, you know, Brownie Mary, Dennis Perrone, Jack Herer. A lot of people worked for a long time to establish the idea in the California psyche that cannabis is a wellness product. It's not about getting high. It's about being well. And I think that that's an important leadership role for California to play as the rest of the world is considering how to deal with coronavirus, as other legal cannabis states are considering how to deal with it. Because what we've learned here is that cannabis is a first line of defense for many, many, many medical issues that otherwise would probably land in a doctor's office or in a pharmacy or maybe in a hospital. And so at a time when we're trying to reduce the load on those medical facilities to the degree possible, having this robust first line of defense available for any adult who wants to walk in and get it is a huge benefit. And then there's, you know, the obvious mental benefits that cannabis can provide in a time like this. Calmness, patience, compassion, reflection, some humor, some sparking of creativity. And those are all really essential things at a time like this. And we know that if people don't have access to cannabis, then they would probably be consuming more alcohol, more tranquilizers, more opioids, and other substances to help them regain some mental calm. So it's a huge paradigm shift, and I think that the rest of the world should emulate it.
Well, Steve, that's very well said, and something that we've wrestled here in Denver and in Colorado with just in the last 24, 48 hours, making sure that cannabis is available as an essential business. Our mayor just yesterday had initially come out and said that there was a distinction that he would allow medical marijuana, medical cannabis businesses to continue to operate, but that adult use or recreational dispensaries could not. We, of course, have that dual license system here. He retreated on that a short while later and allowed both to continue to exist. But we've come a long, long way in a short period of time. And speaking of progress, you've been an advocate for policy reform around the globe, Latin America, Africa, Europe, and beyond, in addition to your native California. And you travel a lot, so there's no travel in place right now. So how are you continuing to make an impact? How are we continuing to move things forward? I recall a rally and a talk you had given in Medellin, Colombia last summer, and some of the things that represents a lot of progress in that part of the world. Will this virus interrupt that progress? Will it stall that policy reform around the globe because we've got, quote-unquote, bigger fish to fry right now?
No, I don't think so. What I've learned about social change and times of crisis is that times of crisis often offer an opportunity for change. Crises are the time when it becomes clear that what was working before is not working at the present time, and people become open to considering shifts in the paradigm. And so, no, I think it's a time that's really ripe for change. And I think that the experience that a lot of people are going to have with cannabis over the period of this virus is really going to popularize and solidify the notion that cannabis really is a wellness product, that it really is essential to living a well-balanced life. And I think that there, at the same time, we are seeing that the credibility of a lot of authoritarian rulers around the world is kind of crumbling. You can take a look at what happened in China, where the authorities tried to lock up the first doctor who tried to sound the alarm. They arrested him. They hounded him into signing a confession saying he was wrong. In Iran, the clerics lied about it, and they have this huge outbreak. In Italy, it's no coincidence that they have extreme right-wing government there. And, of course, we've seen this, same tendency on the part of the right wing in the United States now, where they're even talking about restarting the economy before we even have seen any kind of real evaluation of the situation that we're dealing with. So I think that the credibility of some of the biggest opponents of cannabis is going to come out of this crisis severely weakened. And I think that the benefits of cannabis are going to come out of this crisis reinforced.
Well, and as we think about all these shifts that are happening, you have done a lot of work with the Last Prisoner Project. Would you tell us a little bit about what that is and also how the coronavirus is now playing a role that's kind of shifting your focus in regards to the Last Prisoner Project?
Sure. The Last Prisoner Project is a nonprofit organization that I founded approximately a year ago. And it has one very singular purpose, and that is to ensure that as we build this new legal cannabis industry all around the world, that we make sure that the people who are in prison for cannabis crimes, for doing something which is now legal, are released as part of the process. And you would think that would just be part of it, right? That if you're going to say that society's decided that something shouldn't be a crime anymore, then people who are in prison for that thing that we decided shouldn't be a crime anymore should be released. But that's not happening for the most part. And so the Last Prisoner Project was founded in order to address that issue. And we've seen a lot of very generous support from the legal industry, also from the entertainment industry, and have been working on building a number of different programs. But the coronavirus has made our work much, much more urgent. And the situation, imagine, right? Could you imagine being in prison right now? I've been spending the past couple of weeks doing every single thing I could to bring things under my control, my food, my water, my family, everything. But in prison, you don't have control over anything. You don't have control over who's sleeping in the same room with you. You don't have control over how close you are to people. You don't have control over your ability to have supplies to keep yourself safe. You don't even have control over the air that you breathe. So, unsurprisingly, we're seeing some really horrible things now. We've heard from prisoners all over the country. In some cases, they've been able to smuggle out photographs of the conditions, and it's just scary. We have situations where guards are hoarding and pilfering toilet paper. No hand sanitizer or disinfectant or masks are available. You can't even have hand sanitizer or disinfectant in prison because of the alcohol content in them. Some of the photographs that we've seen have just been, the only disinfectant that is available, the only thing that people can do is wash their hands. And so we have photographs now of these old grody sponges sitting on a sink with old grody little crumbly pieces of soap sitting on top of them. And this is what people are supposed to be using to disinfect themselves. So, unsurprisingly, we're seeing spread now. We have inmates across the country in local and state prisons that we know have tested positive, both correctional officers and convicts. Even Harvey Weinstein was just diagnosed with COVID in a New York State prison. So it's spreading, and we're just super concerned about these folks and trying to do everything that we can to help our constituents who, unfortunately, are in a situation where they can't help themselves.
And it seems like our politicians, because this is, at least in theory, a matter of first impression, although we've been through things like this as a society previously, maybe not as widely spread as it was in 1918 or in the early 1900s related to the Spanish flu. But we look back and some of the decisions it seems like our policymakers, our politicians are leading us towards are, choosing between economic progress and sustainability versus human lives. And that's not a good position that we should be in as a society. But talking about the economic side of things, just really wanted to focus on some of the things that we've seen roll out in California. We've seen, and you've been an active participant in the discussion surrounding taxation on cannabis and how that's sort of allowed the traditional market to continue to thrive versus the commercial market. How does the current situation, the taxes, and just the fact that California's really had a lot of challenges getting its arms around that traditional market and how it impacts the commercial regulated market. Are we at a crossroads right now related to taxing authorities, the combination of the three agencies related to the cannabis control in California? Are we at a crossroads where people have to choose which side of the fence they're on?
I think, unfortunately, those crossroads have been blocked by a huge amount of unnecessary and excessive regulation and taxation. The people who are in the traditional market in California, for the most part, would be very happy to be able to make a living for their families without having to worry about being arrested and being imprisoned. Unfortunately, instead of being the poster child for how to legalize cannabis, California has largely become the poster child for how not to legalize cannabis. And there's some pretty simple solutions to it. The question is whether or not the political will would be there to implement those solutions.
Well, then we've seen patterns emerge amongst multiple markets in the United States that have legalized. Bob, I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit to some of the issues that California is facing, how we've seen those patterns emerge in other markets, and really is there hope? What will it take in order to get to the other side?
Well, I mean, California has been a challenge. Of course, you've got over 40 million people. You've got a lot of laws that have taken place over the last 15 to 20 years that created sort of a patchwork of patients' rights, local control, local authority. And then you had, you know, recent legislation over the last two and a half, three years that sort of created state top-down regulatory control in California. But we haven't seen that necessarily implemented until fairly recently. And that's why I suggest, Steve, that, you know, perhaps there is a crossroads, and you, as you astutely point out, that the crossroads might be blocked. My point is, as an outside observer, you have a you have these dispensaries, these outlets that were sourcing from perhaps the traditional market, and the products that were being cultivated in the so-called regulated market were also making their way into the sort of more traditional market world. But as we sit here today, you've got a lack of enforcement, an inability to enforce, an underfunded agency, an agency that doesn't seem to want to work with the commercial industry to understand what it needs. To Steve's point, it's over-regulated to the point that maybe it constrains the actual evolution of this industry. Plus, you really didn't have accountability. If you're not, you know, looking at the supply chain on the commercial side, then that encourages folks to potentially participate on both sides of the industry, that being the traditional market and that being the commercial regulated market. So that, it's almost like a catch-22. It's almost as if the state's saying, well, until you, the industry, can get your act together, we're not going to work with you. And then the industry's saying, well, you're over-regulating us and effectively taxing us out of existence. So something's got to give at some point. And to Steve's point, you don't really have, you've got an opportunity, particularly Southern California, just because of its large consumer base, to be a worldwide leader in how to regulate and control cannabis from a government perspective. And yet it doesn't seem to want to take that baton. It doesn't want that responsibility. What gives, Steve?
Well, let's take a look at how we got here and how we can get out of it. We got here because the state of California did two things simultaneously. Number one, implemented a licensing requirements and operating requirements for growers and manufacturers that required those growers and manufacturers to have access to big piles of money. It was a very expensive transition, and most growers in California are small family growers. They didn't have a quarter of $1 million or $1 million or $2 million to make that transition. So on the one hand, you have a whole lot of growers who used to be supplying the medical cannabis market quite effectively, who were locked out of the legal market. At the same time, taxes were imposed. This was happened on January 1st, 2018. New taxes were imposed on cannabis that raised the cost of cannabis in most dispensaries around the state by about 50%. Keep in mind, California has a very robust underground traditional industry that doesn't have to absorb the cost of regulations or taxes. So what happened is, and I saw it with my own eyes in my own shops, is you had cannabis consumers post January 1st, 2018, coming into dispensaries and running out of them with sticker shock. And they would run right out into the arms of growers who had been denied licenses. And so you had this perfect storm, which reinvigorated the traditional market. How do we deal with it? Well, you don't deal with it with brute force. There's no amount of enforcement in the world that's going to change the situation. That's been tried and failed for 75 years. What should happen is that the state of California should do two things. One, declare a two-year tax holiday on all cannabis taxes up and down the board, state, local, all of it, and put us on an equal basis with the traditional market. And then two, they should take the top 5,000 licensed applicants whose license applications were turned down for whatever reason and approve them and welcome them into the legal system. And if you did that, then you would start seeing, instead of an outflow of consumers and operators from the license system, you would start seeing flow back into it. And that's what really needs to happen.
That's an excellent perspective. And you know, from the ground up, things need to change. Now, as you look, though, at, you know, the folks that are predicting the future of the cannabis industry, I think a lot of people before the coronavirus epidemic pandemic were looking at California as being very strong in 2020 in the development of its commercial sector. And perhaps that's mistaken, but that's an outsider's perspective from many folks that are investors and government regulators that look at it and say, well, all of a sudden you've got this track and trace system in place. We can track every single gram that's in this commercial regulated system. So of course, that's going to make the industry more robust. The government agencies will accordingly treat it more like a traditional or at least an accepted business. And therefore, things are going to be rosy in California in 2020. Whether that's true or not, let's assume that the commercial industry is at least going to better strengthen its base, because it has to right now, or else it won't exist anymore. And it has to adapt given the certain rules, unless the government's willing to play ball and negotiate and or put policies in place along the lines of what you described. How does the coronavirus interrupt all of this potential progress that was to occur, or at least in theory was supposed to occur, in California in 2020?
You know, I think that it's quite a leap to assume that that progress, to just assume that that progress, absent some policy changes, was going to happen in California. I think it's based on a fundamental misunderstanding of the impact of the trace system. But what I think that we're going to see, as with all economic activity, is that things are going to get frozen into place. And what is working is probably going to keep on going in cases where we're lucky, and what hasn't been working may be feeling even more distress. So we're fortunate that the whole industry has been declared an essential industry in California. We're seeing significant lift out of that. I think that that we will see some permanent changes in the shape of the industry and some of the ways that cannabis fulfillment happens. You know, for example, we now have, for the first time, curbside delivery, curbside pickup at dispensaries statewide, because the BCC issued a waiver. They previously weren't allowing that, and now it's allowed. Well, I think people are going to find out that they really like curbside pickup, and that it's very convenient, and that it works well for shops. And moving forward, I think people are going to continue to be concerned about social contact, exposing themselves to crowds more than they need to. And so I think you're going to see the retail service model in California shifting to adapt to those kinds of changes.
Yeah. No, that's a great point. And, you know, with all of the uncertainty and the concern facing our global society right now with coronavirus, we have found that it is very important to give hope and to try to give some perspective to the situation. We've been saying around here that panic is contagious, but so is leadership. And I'm wondering, Steve, someone like you who travels so much, who gets to talk to so many people on the front lines, whether it's cannabis related or anything else, what is the most important message to send to the global community right now?
Well, I think that the message to send is that even amidst all of the horror that we are experiencing and probably will continue to experience for some time, there is a very precious opportunity here. In the same way that visionary plants like cannabis help us disengage from our normal thought patterns, and in that disengagement, frequently we get new insights, the whole world now has been taken out of its daily routine, its normal flow of decision-making. Millions and millions of us have been put in situations basically of enforced reflection and thought. And I think that we should take advantage of it. And we should really, as a community and as a species, be contemplating about what led us to this place, and then have a as clear an understanding as we can, coming out of it, what we need to do to avoid to getting back into it. And for cannabis community in particular, look, I just got done doing a lot of even fresh research on cannabis. And what I can tell you is that we have been using this plant, literally, us human beings, since we became human beings, and maybe even before we were fully human. And there have been a lot of changes in that time in the social status, the religious status, the economic status of cannabis, both for industrial purposes and for ingestion. But the cannabis, use of cannabis, just keeps on growing. As far as I can tell, that's something that's been happening for a long time around the world, and it's not going to stop.
Well, Steve, thank you for your time today. Stay safe, be well, and we look forward to seeing you sometime in the future when we're all allowed to leave our houses again.
Thanks so much, Bob. Be well.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Hoban Minutes special series on coronavirus and cannabis. You can head on over to hoban.law for more information on this podcast or the Hoban Law Group. If you have any ideas for subjects that we should be covering or any questions you want to pose to Bob or myself, shoot us an email at media@hoban.law. And stay tuned for the next episode on this special series, Coronavirus and Cannabis.